Good morning. Welcome to the Lessard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council business meeting for January the 7th, 2016. Happy New Year to everyone. Let's go to the item on the approve the agenda before you. Member Kingston.
I would like to modify the agenda. I would like to add an item, and that is to make the CPL appointment somewhere along the line. So if you're ready to do so, up to you. And also, I'd like to extend the time on item number 7 to take advantage of a quorum of members that we can start actually checking off some of the items on our work list on the call-in criteria. My approach on that is that the whole council approve each item so that we don't end up with a whole package, because I believe that bogs down in discussion. I'd like to have item by item discussion and approval so that we make some progress at every meeting. And if the quorum of members can stay, are the current members able to stay longer than 10:30 today? So is there any reason we can't extend the adjournment time? I don't mind if we have the opportunity for the public to address the council first, if that makes it smoother. Mm-hmm. We could switch 7 and 8 and extend the adjournment time. And then continue to work after people have to leave too. Whatever we can get done today, I'd like to get it done because we do have a deadline.
Very good.
Thank you.
You've heard those suggestions. Give a motion to approve the agenda with those changes. Member Kingston?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Accept your motion.
Thank you.
Discussion? Senator Saxon.
Mr. Chair, I have to be at another working group meeting for a special session at 10 o'clock. I'd be willing to check in and come back. I mean, if I'm the only guy that's making a difference. So.
Very good.
Thank you.
Further discussion? No further discussion, and the motion to approve the agenda with those minor changes, including the CPL appointment and flipping number 7 and 8 around, and continuing to have discussion on the call criteria and request for proposals. We'll continue as part of the meeting. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried. Thank you. Agenda is approved. Go to the next item, and that's the minutes. The December meeting. Senator Saxon to approve the minutes as presented. Discussion on the motion of the minutes. Hearing none, place the question before the council. All those in favor of the minutes as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried and minutes are approved. Thank you. Members, report any conflict of interest with regard to today's agenda. Hearing none, we'll move to the Executive Director's report. Mark?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, a handful of things on the Executive Director's report. First of all, just give you an update on the land acquisition report. There's no summary in your packets because it's not done yet. We're still, actually this week, the information has still been trickling in. Joe's been hard at work on it, and we've been meeting as a staff to go over things to try to figure out all the nuances of it. It will be finished next week by the 15th for the legislature, but no reports for you, no summary report for you today on that. The draft accomplishment plans for the projects receiving additional funding. Actually, Sandy, as in your packets, you have four accomplishment plans that have been revised, and Sandy will give us a rundown on those. Sandy?
Just really quickly, the Northern Tallgrass, of the $657,000 additional recommendation, $544,000 went into fee and easement acquisition, which was the main activity of this program, and the remaining dollars were divided evenly between admin budget items proportionately. The WPA revision, the full $657,000 was put into fee acquisition and contracts proportionately. Trout Unlimited, the $657,000 stayed in the main activity of contract supplies, professional services, personnel did not increase. And then the CPO program, the full $1.974 million went into the contract line to be distributed for small grants.
Thank you, Sandy. Any questions for Sandy on that from the council? All good news. I want to thank the project managers for working with her promptly to get that stuff accomplished. Thank you very much. In your packets, there's a yellow landscape table. That's actually an update, one of these periodic updates we talked about from CPL. So thank you, Jessica, for putting that together. And this is the CPL coordinator. Very nice report and some really interesting information on how that's all working out in the round one awards. Besides that, I wanted to fill you in on a couple of other things. From a public outreach standpoint, the council received an email from us earlier, a couple weeks ago, I guess, regarding the McKnight Foundation Grants Workshop coming up on the 13th. But before I get into that, just to let you know that on the 1st of December, Joe, we're always looking for outreach opportunities, ways to bring our message to groups or individuals, government units who might be and encouraging them to come before the council, come to CPL with ideas, with grant requests. So Joe actually gave a presentation to Freshwater Society. They had their Metro Summit for Lakes and River Group on December 1st, so he gave a presentation there. I gave one at the Minnesota State Association of Watershed Districts annual convention. And then that was on December 4th. On the 13th, we have the McKnight Foundation hosting another grants workshop. And it's not just about outdoor heritage grants, but it's clean water land and legacy funds, basically, as well as environmental trust funds. So there's going to be several speakers. It'll be it's open to public, but they are full. I think within just a few days, they had a full attendance list of sending out the invitation. The full meeting, about 60. Public attendees coming in, about 70 with the speakers. But that's some really good news. That'll happen on the 13th over at McKnight, and I'll put on a presentation there. On the 14th, I'll be running up to Fergus Falls. Actually, I have to do a presentation to the Fergus Falls Fish and Game Club's annual meeting. And then on my way up, I actually got an email and an invitation to come to the West Central Initiative Foundation office and meet with them about their hosting of one of these workshops, grants workshop as well. So hopefully we'll have more of those types of outreaches to the public, and hopefully what that will turn into is more collaboratives from more potential partners coming with more new ideas for not just outdoor heritage and CPL, but also for the other funding sources. Jane?
That's great. I think more outreach the better, but I think that it's really incumbent on counselors to attend along with staff at every possible opportunity, one or two, you know, whoever could make themselves available. I think it's really important that counselors attend and give them enough notice, make themselves available to the public in that venue, in those venues. So I'm asking that we get notified when these are going to be and ask for possible volunteer counselors to participate.
So noted. I'll take that and make sure I let you all know. I'll put this out in an email to you, an email form as well, so you have the dates in case somebody does want to attend. I should mention McKnight, at this point, they're asking only one person from each organization to come because of the, otherwise it'll limit the public attendees. So, and actually, even the public organizations are asking one because there's such a long waiting list at this point. They are looking at, as I understand, at least they're considering having another one later in the year because of the great turnout or the great demand, it looks like. On another note, where staff is always trying to keep our antenna up with regards to potential little fixes that might be able to be worked on preventively to keep big problems from happening. Most recently, staff has done some consulting with Greg and Janelle, but also MMB, DNR, Fez Forever, TNC, talking about the revenues portion of 978.456 and some potential apparent inadequacies of for some of the areas of declining land holding costs, as well as how the direction of how those revenues produced on a land purchase of OHF dollars may or may not be used. So we're going to continue to discuss that, and then we'll come up with, see if there's a recommendation necessary to come to the council with, the legislators with, and we'll inform you of that later. Come back, and hopefully by February we'll have something, at least to bring you a little further up to date. Marsh Lake, you may have seen in the news, or in the newspapers, I guess, on the internet, that Marsh Lake has had a hiccup happen from the federal side. The president's budget had Marsh Lake funding in it, but that was cut prior to the budget being passed. And Senators Frank and Klobuchar and also Congressman Colin Peterson put in a letter to the Assistant Secretary of the Army asking that part of $20 million that's undesignated allocation to the Corps be earmarked for Marsh Lake. We drafted up a letter that Bob has looked at, and he will be evidently signing that today. The copy is in your packets. That letter is going to the secretary or assistant secretary, urging that same thing to specify some of those $20 million in funds to the Marsh Lake project so it can continue. And we will be copying that to the entire congressional legislation from Minnesota. As well as definitely, I'd encourage each of you, if you feel so needed, either drop a letter to the assistant secretary or encourage her congressional delegation to drop another note or a phone call or something to encourage that. And the last thing I think I had was that in your packets there's a campaign finance and public disclosure letter. That's just a letter reminding you of the deadline is January 25th. We've been asked to remind you all of that deadline for your recertification with their board, if it's necessary. You may, even if, I think if you all received letters, I believe, in December. That's all I have, Mr. Chair. That's their questions.
Questions for Executive Director Johnson? Thank you, Mark. We'll move to item 5 on the agenda then, excuse me, and that's the draft bill language for we have the Jack Pine Forest Crow Wing River Watershed Acquisition Item. That's agenda item 5A.
Mr. Chair, we have a message here. Ron Mashir is trying to call in for the meeting, so that's good. And then Amanda is setting up the room.
All right, we'll just hold for a minute here until Member Shira gets connected in.
Because Mr. Shira's attendance by phone was not pre-announced, and that can offend with that, and that for in the time necessary, he won't be able to vote on issues. Although I don't think these next couple items necessarily are. Maybe a vote. I think he's on location in Kansas.
He's actually in his car driving back.
Is he?
So he told me last night.
That's right. Number to call him like that.
Thank you.
Set up, and we'll just wait for Member Scherer to call in. Meantime, we will move to the draft bill language, and Executive Director Johnson will lead us through that those two items.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First memo is Agenda Item 5A, and this is regarding, as mentioned, FAO2, the Jetline Forest Acquisition Project. It's MDHA's proposal. And there was as a little bit of background, as you remember in the last council meeting, there was Senator Saxon had motioned for the approval of the overall package, and then Representative McNamara had moved to amend that package with additional language under this MDHA proposal for the FAO2, I'll call it, that called for preference. It said preference must be given to parcels that will be transferred to a government entity or a non-governmental organization with expertise in land management. That motion was discussed and it was passed by voice vote. When I went through the audio, there was no dissenting votes on that. But then the overall motion, I should say the amendment passed, but then the overall SACSOG motion was defeated or did not pass. And subsequently, there was a Hartwell motion to approve the package. But that motion did not include this amendment. So we realized that as we were putting the bill language together. And so if you look at your bill, draft bill language of this white set, on page 8, it's lines 8.5 through 8.8. It's highlighted for you. Actually, I think it probably comes across as gray in here. But that's the one sentence that is still in this draft, but it should not be because it was not, it's highlighted, it's in the draft, but it shouldn't be in the bill, it won't be in the bill, because the council did not approve that. So what I'm driving at with that is that we need to, if the council desires to have that additional language on the bill as it moves forward, we need to address that now. We have to have there's a couple of ways to do it. In talking with Greg and Janelle, rather than reopening the whole issue of having a supermajority vote necessary for voting on this to add to the motion or add to the package and then re-forwarding the package, it may be much easier and probably more appropriate. I think that's Ron just beeping in. Mr. Shera, is that you on the phone? I think she's somewhere there. Maybe you can hear us. We can't hear you.
I can hear you.
Hello. We're on...
Hello? Hello?
Yes, Ron. Let's see. I'm going to have to move the phone over this direction or to wherever we're talking. Yeah, or we can... Ron, can you hear it all?
Yes, I hear you.
All right, great. I'll keep the microphone closer to my mouth. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the FAO2, the MDHA proposal, and the additional language on that. I think I spoke with you about this earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. As counsel, I'll continue on here. Rather than reopening appropriation recommendation from the council, it may be better that if the council wishes this additional language to be added onto that appropriation, that there be a motion directing the staff to work with the bill authors toward to include the preference material as or preference language as a technical change within the legislative process.
Okay.
So is there Representative McNamara, this was very much your language proposed, and there was great discussion about it, and it seemed like there was pretty good approval all the way around. In fact, I believe that Executive Director for NDHA, Craig Engwall, also testified that they were supportive of it, they could live with that language. I don't know if you have comments on this.
And maybe I can thank you, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be for counsel, why don't we think I missed it? I couldn't follow the discussion of why do we not think that this got included? Wasn't it our legislative intent and the discussion that this language be included in what we did? Why do we think this language is not included?
Danny, I can answer that because you attached it to a motion which failed, and when I made my motion for approval of the package, it didn't include the piece that was part of the failed motion.
I think it was everybody's intent to have it included.
But I guess my question is, would that would fail my motion? That would be the normal legislative process. I needed to reiterate that. It seems to me I put it in the base. Wouldn't I have modified what was in the base? And it wouldn't have been in Member Hartwell's motion. Wouldn't it have been assumed to be there?
Mr. Chair, members, and I didn't go back and listen to the tape, but for my, if you want to think about it as if you were moving a bill, and instead of moving the bill as amended, he moved the bill, the original bill. So that's why the amendment didn't go on, because the bill as amended motion failed.
So now, Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, I'm in agreement that we should just let the bills, when they go to the legislature, we don't need to deal with it here, but I think that it was our intent that this language be included. And I guess I would ask that anybody that disagrees with that speak up, and maybe we could also Senator Ingebrigtsen and Member Wilkins probably should confirm with them at the next meeting that they're in agreement with the two, so that if we don't, it'd be easier than not. Because of the need for the number of votes and then people not here, it would be inappropriate, I think, to try and modify it. That would not seem correct.
Member Hartwell.
Danny, there are nine of us here.
Yeah.
I mean, if we agree, let's just take a vote to have that language in.
We have nine
but
here.
And then it's done.
Mr. Chair and Member Hartwell, I'm not going to vote for the project. That would be me voting for the bill, and I'm not going to vote for the bill. So we're not going to get nine votes. You want to amend the bill, and I'm on record of being opposed to the bill that's drafted on it, so it'd be, I wouldn't be able to do it. That's why I brought it up, and I don't think it'd be fair.
I was simply suggesting that we have a motion to amend the bill that's in front of us by that language, and we've already approved the bill in essence, and we're just approving that piece of language to be added to the bill.
Could Mr. Chair and Council, would you be able to do that? And that would just take nine votes. Don't we have to vote on the whole package?
There we are. The whole package.
I would think that if we're going to modify the package, we're going to vote on the whole package.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that would be the cleanest system. Or you could set a bad precedent of amending the whole package after the fact.
Mr. Chair, members, I had the other day I spoke with another legislator who had suggested that rather than reopening the entire package, that this could be forwarded as a second recommendation from a number of different ways. One way would be a second recommendation from the council, which is just to add this language. And then the third way would be to, or the other way would be to just direct staff to work with the authors of the bill, as or with the those who are listed as authors for the bill, the legislators, which would be your
myself possibly, as it moves forward, just to make a technical amendment adding that language based on the council's previous support of that language.
Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, I'll ask council this, and then if they think it works, I'll ask for a roll call. What if I ask for the language from 8.5 through 8.8 that's highlighted to be offered as a proposed amendment when the bills come before the first committee in the legislature in both bodies, and then we have a roll call vote that shows that it had unanimous support for that? I see them both nod. So, Mr. Chair, I'm going to move the language on 8.5 through 8.8, the highlighted language, be offered as an amendment, and then that the legislative bodies understand it was the council's wishes that that be included, and it was an oversight. And if we have a roll call, unanimous vote, we know that's got 9 votes from this body, because there's, I think, 10 of us here today. So I think, and I don't see anybody in dissent to the language. It was non-controversial, so that would clarify that. And it keeps us away from a different discussion.
Member Tilley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. I think this is the best approach to take. I would hate to have an unofficial report that encourages the legislature to change what the council has supported. So by doing the way Representative McNamara has laid out and others, I think that keeps our record clear and that we go forward on a positive footstep. And I support that.
On the record.
So we have a motion then by Representative McNamara to include the language in lines 8.5 through 8.8, and that we would have that would be included in the bill.
Mr. Chair, it'd be that the legislative authors hopefully would offer it as an amendment, knowing that the council unanimously, if that's the case, or whatever the vote is when we have it at their January 7th meeting, had a discussion, noted it was an oversight, how it happened, and that hopefully the legislature would include it as an amendment. I believe that's the way it would need to be.
This would be a supplemental recommendation from the council.
Correct. That would be the best way to go.
So is there a need for a roll call on a recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I asked for a roll call. Every one of us can do, because I think sometimes if we have a voice vote, someone could say, well, I never voted, or I'm not sure I wanted to support it.
We have a call. We have a request for a roll call on the question then of having those lines added to the and asking the authors of the bill to consider that. Roll call vote.
Ms. Blackburn.
Aye.
Mr. Hartwell.
Yep.
Ms. Kingston.
Aye.
Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative McNamara.
Aye.
Ms. Olson.
Yes.
Senator Sackler.
Yes.
Mr. Tilley.
Yes.
And Mr. King.
Aye.
That's 9 for yes, 0 no.
Motion carries, and that will go to the House authors then. Thank you. We'll move to
I think he said he can't vote.
Right.
I think he needs to understand he can't vote, because he's asking if he can vote.
Oh, did he ask? I couldn't. It's broken up enough. I couldn't understand. Ron, if you
can. Excuse me. If I understand that, I cannot vote.
My understanding is that since it was not announced previous to the meeting, that you're not allowed to vote. You're included as a member in attendance, but not allowed to vote on any issues.
It depends on who's going to vote. Just kidding.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be appropriate if Member Shera wanted to tell us if he could vote, how he would have voted, and that would be part of the record.
Well, I would have voted yes, but I'm a little for sure, because staff knew I was not going to be at this meeting, and through the motions of getting the right telephone numbers and everything else, and now I find out I can't vote.
Ron, this is Mark. My apology with that misunderstanding. We didn't have the 10 days notice necessary, which would have provided the ability to vote.
I had this phone number 10 days before, it doesn't make much sense for me to sit there and miss for 4 hours if I can't participate.
My apology. That's must be my oversight, and I'm sorry for that.
I'll hang in just a little bit. I might have five down here chances, and the bag is a little slow.
Thank you.
Detective Director Johnson, then on the item 5B.
Members, next memo item is 5B, and it is regarding the FA09, which was the Wires appropriation. There are actually three items here, but I'll try to go through them in order with you, and maybe we can discuss them in that order. That's probably the easiest and best. Now, if you look in that packet of the draft language on page 12, lines 12.8 through 12.28, or pardon me, 12.18 through 12.28, I think for some reason I'm off just a little bit, but that's roughly where it is. My copy shows 12.17 through 12.26. There is a additional language that was added in after much discussion by the council and amendments, or actually was within the motion by within Member Hartwell's motion. But this language, I'll read it to you. The White Earth Nation in cooperation. Let's back up, if I may. I'm going to have you turn over your memos to the back side of the memo. There's the appropriation language, which starts out $2.188 million. It's the top paragraph. The second paragraph is in the draft bill. The second paragraph is added in, and that's that lines 12.17 through 12.26. That is the result of the motions and interpretation of those motions by staff in working with Greg and Janelle as well on putting together the draft bill. The third paragraph down, the WEN, is White Earth Nation proposed additional language, which is slightly different than the original proposed additional bill. And then you see the next paragraph down is the verbatim. So let the verbatim from the audio. So let me go through those first of all. With the as the bill was being put together, the interpretation or trying to put the language into bill form was what is in the draft bill. It's the White Earth Nation in cooperation with the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall create a jointly agreed upon management plan for all lands acquired with this appropriation. To include a single management unit where White Earth Nation's tribal hunting, trapping, fishing, and gathering seasons and bag limits will be utilized for tribal and non-tribal members alike. There was a question, which I think was a very appropriate question, why is management unit used or management used at all when it was not in the verbatim language? And in my mind at the time, it was because DNR generally doesn't talk about hunting zones. They talk about permit management units or management units or permit units. So I was trying to put it into a language that would kind of coincide with what DNR speak is. That may have not been appropriate, but that's part of the reason we're bringing it back here to the council, so that you all see this and we decide exactly what is going to be in that language. The White Earth Nation, their proposed language, changes that quite significantly in that they say that the Commission of Natural Resources may establish a special zone, and it continues on. doesn't talk about the collaboration or cooperate or the need for White Earth Nation and the DNR to work together on it or create it jointly, and it has the word "may." If we go to the verbatim language, which maybe I should have started with, but the motion itself was, and this is directly from the transcripts, quote, the motion is to move the package with the amendment that the White Earth Band and DNR create a special single hunting zone on this property that is based upon the White Earth Band's tribal hunting, fishing, trapping, and gathering seasons and limits. Due to the comments that I've received and the concerns over the proposed language that's in the bill, as well as the proposed language that White Earth had come up with, my suggestion would be that, and talking to Greg and Janelle, I think they can comment on this. I don't want to speak for them, but my understanding is they also would agree that probably the best thing to do is for us to go with this close, go with the verbatim language from the motion, and then allow for any adjustment from that to happen through technical changes within the legislative process. That would mean that the language you see in this draft would be changed, put the verbatim in, and then the changes would happen during the legislative process. And there would be no necessity for motions here, but I want to make sure that whatever goes into the bill is what the council wanted, and not some improper interpretation. I should mention also that another reason with us not, with me not being settled with any interpretations of the language here at this point is that when the council passed the motion, there was no caveat for council or staff to adjust the language, as I understand has been done in the past regularly.
It's pretty normal.
Can I?
Yeah. Representative McNamara?
Well, thank you. To that point, wouldn't it be precedent and common uses that's understood to be, or does that need to be mentioned every time? I'm asking the council if that. I think the precedence would be that. I guess the reason I'm asking that the interpretation would be, I think this language should be flipped because the legislative intent maybe wasn't completely met here and we need to change. That's what I'm wondering. But isn't that an understood thing, or do we have to do that every time?
Mr. Chair, Mr. McNamara, I usually ask for that every time. In conference committees or other places, that generally we go with verbatim language unless there's a lesser, especially in a conference committee, yes, or because that's the final, you can't catch it again later. But I think Mr. Johnson is correct in this, and I recommended to him, I think Janelle did too, that it should be just a verbatim language that gets included, since there was no authorization to adjust it. And apparently there are some differences of opinion over how it should read. That as long as we have that we should just, that verbatim language should be included, and it can be changed down the road if people need to change it or whatever. But at this point in time, it seems that going with the verbatim language makes the most sense, because that would be like an amendment in committee where you adopt the amendment and maybe you need to fix it down the road, but you just adopt it the way it is.
Thank you. My recommendation would be that we use the verbatim language it utilized as additional language as that final option down there. As a side, White Earth doesn't have the authority to create a special single hunting zone, so that's something we probably should have caught at the last meeting, because it's the commissioner of the natural resources that has to do that. It's not White Earth, so saying White Earth and the commissioner are going to create is probably technically incorrect. I'm sure that will get fixed in the legislature, but I think we need to go with the verbatim language and not what was originally proposed.
Member Hartwell.
I agree.
Member Kingston?
Well, I agree too, and I just don't think we have any authority to do anything other than that. I mean, you can talk about, we've done these motions many, many times in the past where we say we'd like staff to work on appropriate verbiage, then they come back and we approve it or not. It's always up and incumbent to the council with help from staff to verbalize these things, but obviously we're not going to get an agreement on this, and all we have is the verbatim, period, without an advance understanding especially.
So the staff would be including the verbatim in the bill, unless there's a motion to do otherwise. Mr. Kingston.
And just to clarify, this is different than the 5A because that required an amendment language, and this was just an error that we're correcting from the record. Okay.
Very good. Thank you for that feedback and for your input. Thank you. Appreciate it. Again, going to number two, staff is, we're looking for clarity. I'm looking for clarity especially. As you know, staff has to look forward from a standpoint, presuming that we have to presume that the bill will pass. And then what are we prepared for as we go forward? So part of our preparation is looking at what should the accomplishment plan language be for considerations for the accomplishment plan. In this case, there will be other contract between DNR and the tribe, which will have additional language in this for their lawyers to work out. But there are a couple of considerations I'd like to bring to your attention. One is that at the December meeting and in the audio also, it was very apparent that at least one member emphasized that it would be primary and peremptory to release rent. Let's back up. That before any land would be purchased or any funds would be let to allow land to be purchased, that the agreement on the hunting zone would have to happen. And if that did not happen, then the funding would not be allowed. I just wanted to make sure that was the intent of the council. I believe it is, and looking back through, I see that's in approving. Ron, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, did you have a comment? I thought I heard you say something.
No, I was trying to listen. It's a little difficult, but go ahead.
Okay. So, with that in mind, if that is peremptory, then I have another question, and that is that if there, and maybe this is more for the contract between DNR and the tribe, although I need to consider it at some point, and that's that would it be that continued ownership of the land would also be conditional upon continued implementation of the hunting zone?
Of course.
All right. I just wanted to make sure that I had that correct, and that so we'll just consider that as we move forward into the appropriation or into the accomplishment plan language and so on.
Senator Sackett.
And Mr. Chair, that's kind of consistent with what we did on the Fond du Lac.
The Fond du Lac is completely different. We didn't require consideration even.
Yeah, I know that.
But everything else is, you know, you don't use it right, you give the land back.
That's what I'm talking about. That's
the movies.
Yes. Every project. Right.
Oh, yeah.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. That covers that. Unless Mr. Tilley has that.
Member Tilley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, it occurs to me, what if DNR and the White Earth Nation decide that this area should be closed to public hunting? Would that meet the criteria that we have? And the thought behind that is the most important thing here is to protect this property. to make sure that it's there for wildlife habitat. If we go ahead with the language that we have laid out here, and the White Earth Nation and the DNR agree that there will be no public hunting season here, would that meet the criteria that we're laying out? The point being, we want to protect this community for habitat purposes. That's our, that's the mission of this council. So we are able to protect this 2,000 acres, and the White Earth Nation and the DNR agree to have no hunting season, would that, that would be the same hunting season for both bodies, then we would be okay.
Member Kingston.
I would submit again, it's no different than any other acquisition. Hunting rules are regulated by the commissioner, and so would this be. And sometimes they're canceled, like moose.
Yep. Yep. Okay.
Further discussion or questions with regard to that point? Okay. Nothing further under item 5. We'll move to item 6.
On the tables in front of you, there was a final report from the with regards to the Grand Marais Creek Outlet Restoration. Or Sandy's handing that up now. I see. The final report for your records. There's another wonderful big handout for you as well. Ron will keep copies for you on this. Myron Desme is the with the Red Lake Watershed District. He's the project manager for this project, and he's here to give us their final. They're done. He's here to give us a glowing report of what happened. We're looking forward to it.
Thank you, Council. Mark, I would like to thank Amanda for helping us get this set up, and Sandy, God bless you for helping us through the funding process and making sure all our paperwork was done, and the 3 years that we started with this project, or got the funding anyway. The Grand Marais Creek project, we have a timeline. It's a long process, but we will go through a lot of these items during the presentation. It's up to the council, but I mean, if you want to interrupt us as we go for questions, that's very fine with us, so just feel free. The gentleman next to me is Jeff Langan. He was the engineer for the project. He worked with DNR to help design the channel for fish passage structures for the channel design. And he was the chief engineer on this project. And I wanted to make sure that I drove all the way up here to give a final presentation on this project, and if there's any hydraulic questions or any stuff that I probably can't answer, that I would make sure that Jeff was here to do that as well. So,
Could you please spell your name?
My name is Myron, M-Y-R-O-N, J-E-S-M-E.
Jasmine?
Just me. Just me.
Just you.
Just me.
And Jeff?
Jeff Langan, L-A-N-G-A-N.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And shown on slide number 1, we are located up in northwestern Minnesota. We are the largest watershed district in the state of Minnesota. The project is located in what we call the Grand Marais sub-watershed. This area, as you can see, is in the prairie region, and it's very important to identify that because of funding that came forth as part of this project because it's in the prairie region. This is a map of our watershed district. You can see we're 6,000 square miles approximately. We encompass all the way from East Grand Forks, all the way into North Home, Cooch King County. All the waters are drained into the Red Lake River, or Red Lake, the upper and lower Red Lakes, and into the Red Lake River is part of our watershed district. And I think this is important. The mission statement of the Watershed District, and I'm not sure if all of you understand really what Watershed Districts do, but we reduce flooding and flood damages and to seek and improve water quality. And this is a big one. Enhance fish and wildlife habitat through sound water management. I started with the Watershed District in 2003. When we started with this mission statement, we had a lot of landowners at this meeting. And if you know up in northwestern Minnesota, sometimes the DNR and the watershed districts and the locals, the locals sometimes don't look at DNR so highly, but when we put fish and wildlife habitat in our mission statement, there's a lot of landowners that wanted that struck. And I remember my cousin was one of them. And I said, I looked at him, I said, I know you love to hunt and fish. You go to Lake of the Woods all the time, and you deer hunt, and you goose hunt, so why would you want that in a mission statement? And he had no response, but ultimately our board passed that mission statement. It's an important one for, as you work, go through project. It's kind of funny because this project really got its first start back when Plenty was the governor, and he had a clean water initiative, and he had probably four pilot projects that were all over Minnesota. And one of us was chosen for the Grand Marais to really investigate how natural resource enhancement and flood damage reduction can work hand in hand. So this really was the first project or the first part of money we got to actually even start the investigation into these types of projects. These maps are kind of hard to see, but it just shows the Grand Marais sub-watershed, which is about a 300-square-mile area. We had a lot of land treatment projects prior to coming to the council for funding for the Grand Marais Creek outlet restoration. We had some upland management, over 1,000 acres of wetland restoration projects. We had some flood damage reduction projects, as you can see in the blue. And then we also had some channel restoration, smaller channel restoration projects downstream of some of these projects. This being one of them. We had a local landowner that back in the 50s, the channel was straightened. The natural channel was straightened for easier farming, they thought. Found out that it didn't work very well. It was always wet. The water always wanted to go to where your channel was, so it made it difficult to farm. So the landowner actually approached the watershed district when we were doing this project to try and restore that project, the channel, back to its original course. We did that. We got an easement from the landowner, restored the channel back to its original course, which is kind of shown in this map. It's really hard to see, but there was a straight line. They just went from one point A to point B, straight line, and we restored the sinuosity of the channel with setback levees and the buffer strip area. This was actually a CREP sign up also through the Board of Water and Soil Resources. This is just a pre-construction, during construction, and just when it was seeded, and this is really what it looks like today. Now we get to the Grand Marais Creek. That's what the Lassard Sands out there. This council funded back in 2012. This channel is located north of East Grand Forks, approximately 7 miles. It's a 22-mile channel, about 26-mile channel that was cut off back in 1905. I wish these were a little clearer, but I didn't realize what kind of projectors we were going to have here. So, but there is to cut off 6 miles of channel is a public project that cut a channel 1.25 miles straight to the river. That happened in about 1905. So cut off the regular Grand Marais Creek channel for that 6.5 miles for over 100 years. In 1920, the landowners found out they made a huge mistake because it started eroding some fierce. They just cut a channel. You cut a channel, the river elevation's here, and pretty soon that channel wants to try and get to the same elevation as the river. So sediment up to 700 tons a year was going into the Red River of the North. But it was too expensive in the 1920s to fix it. They let it go until today. There's three real projects, components to this project. There was, when we first came to the Lassard Sams for funding, we didn't get to first base. The second time we came, they identified you identified that there was two components to the project, and we knew that, but we weren't sure really how to handle it at that time because the Constitutional Amendment money was pretty new. But the cutout channel at 1.25 miles that we wanted to stabilize was really a clean water project. And so the council said, you will get that addressed through clean water funding, and we'll maybe look at this one later on down the road. So we actually did that. We went to the Board of Water and Soil Resources. We received a grant to help stabilize that area that was contributing 700 tons of sediment due to the Red River. We had that. We finished that project, and then we came back to the council in 2012 to restore the 6.5 miles of the Grand Marais. And I'm not going to get into, you got the handout so you can really see the components of the project. And since you have the handout, I think it's important to show that there's a lot of wetland restoration projects. A portion in this project included a lot of ditch plugs. It took land out of agriculture into permanent prairie. We have a lot of habitat species, which is wetland species, upland species, or vegetation. So in a nutshell, 400 acres of land was taken out of production and into some sort of wetland or upland prairie. We'll just continue on. If you look in where the diversion structure was in place, that was where the channel was actually diverted to the river back in 1905. That's this slide right here. And Jeff will get into the structure a little bit farther into the project, but I just kind of want to give you an identifier where we are when we start talking about these projects or these components later on into the presentation. There was a lot of, it wasn't an obstacle because the landowners never asked for this project. They didn't even know why we wanted to do this project. They couldn't understand why we wanted to restore this channel. I mean, a lot of the channel was being farmed through. There was over 8 feet of silt in it. It wasn't really a channel anymore. Some of it was a real poor grade wetland. Like I say, some of them farmed through it, so they had private crossings, and they were just simply culverts with their crossing to get from one side of that little wetland mass to another. So that was one of the obstacles we had was when we were going to construct this project, we still had to give the landowners access to the other side of the channel because it's landlocked in a lot of areas. They would require them to get through private lands that they don't know other landowners own to get to their other side of the fields, so to speak. So we had to install various private crossings, and Jeff will show those later in the presentation. The Grand Marais project, we broke them up into project numbers, and the cutoff channel and the restoration. And this is just kind of a slide to show you what the components or what the cutoff channel project was. I won't get into that so much because that was funded by the Clean Water Fund. I think the background is kind of important. I touched on the 1900s where the cutoff ditch was constructed. But really the background is just to get the 6 miles of the Grand Marais Creek back to connected to the 20 miles of the previous channel. There was various reports done dating back into the 80s to get this accomplished. And the most recent, the Army Corps of Engineers actually had this as a 206 project back in 2011. And they actually completed the study. They ran out of money, never got to finish the study, so it couldn't be handed out as a public document. And we were already kind of working on it with them, and then we just went without them, I guess, for better word, I guess. Project cost, funding sources, environmental coordination was really a project deterrent. Very expensive project. And we weren't quite sure how we were going to handle that cost, but we figured we had to at least get a plan scope and to find out what the cost was, and then at a later time we'll see what we could do to get funding, and that's ultimately where we went. As you can see, the background goes back in this sub-watershed back to 86, where the watershed district really became active. You go through the timeline, just go back to 2010, we our first attempt for LASARC SAMS funding. Second attempt was in 2011. We got the funding in the 2012 legislation, and we started our environmental permitting process at that time. The project began was funded in 2012. The project was ordered by the Red Lake Watershed District Board of Managers in October of 2012. 2012, the cutoff channel was completed because we'd already went and got funding for that. We'll just look at the, you can see the timeline, I don't have to go through it. But I just want to stress, when you look at some of these pictures, this project is brand new. I mean, we just finished it, really final it this year, September 2015. So some of the photos you're going to see still isn't vetched up properly, because one of the things that really delayed the final project was the seeding. With the prairie grass, there's a real tight timeline on when you can actually seed it, when you're going to get your first bang for your best bang for your buck. So we actually missed 2014 with flooding, where we couldn't get out in a timely manner to seed it. So we had to wait until 2015. I think when you look at the next slide, and that's, you guys have seen this a million times, I'm sure, but it's your legislation, the state, the legislators put out for the funding of the Constitutional Amendment, and the yellow really highlights what this council can use for, to fund projects, and we really think that we nail a lot of these components in this project. Yep.
Member
was the only timing delay the planning season that one time? I mean, did this march along in accordance with what you
said? This project really went very well. Everything from permitting, we have project teams when we do these projects. We have a lot of our permitting entities sitting at the table as we design these projects, the DNR, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, MPCA. All these folks sit on a project team. So when we're developing these projects, we already answer a lot of their questions before the permit is even applied for. So it really made it, the permitting usually can delay things a lot. In this case, it worked out.
Yeah, I mean, everybody was so on board on this project, so it made the permitting as clean as any project I've ever worked on. So.
You did a lot of prep work.
Yeah.
A lot of prep work. And what I thought was going to be a slam dunk, it turned out to be fine. But since we had that core study, I thought we could just insert that lot of their findings in our permit application. But since it never went up the ladder to get approved, we couldn't even use their own document for the permitting. So it made it a little bit, it took me by surprise because it was their document. And I just thought, well, if we use their verbiage, it should be really good. And it turned out, well, this one can't use that because it never was approved. So, but anyway, but you look at the outcomes, and it's to restore and sustain 6 miles of functional natural stream, channel habitat. And I don't really want to glaze over this. There's some parties or some presentations that we've already given where we can really kind of glaze over this. But from this council, I think you really, and I won't read them all, but I think this is really something that we need to look at from the outcomes, because this is really the nuts and bolts of why you fund this project. So we want to make sure that you understand what we feel we've accomplished, and we can quantify that over time. And I think that's an important thing, is that we do keep monitoring this project over time as it, and with the assistance of DNR Fisheries, we're hoping to get some sort of agreement with them where they can come out and monitor it with us to help us, because they're the experts. Project features, it goes into, what we really, used for criteria to help get our outcomes to where we hope they would be. The land acquisition, of course, was is always an obstacle in these types of projects. You're taking sugar beet, soybean land out of production, put it into native prairie, or if this one landowner was actually going to do plant trees. Timing didn't work out for him very well on that, so we had to amend our plan with the help of Sandy to take out some of the flood for the forest area that we did not have in our initial work plan, and we just moved it over to the prairie. But that's where the details where Sandy came in was very helpful for me, because I was saying, well, that's not a big deal, it's just a different
goal, and but it really had to be, you know, amended to change, you know, what in, you know, what we were trying to accomplish. This next slide is just simply the channel design that was really approved by the DNR, really helped with the permitting, you know, that we actually used their experts with Jeff to help design this channel, and it's a U-shaped channel. It's not a trapezoid, your standard trapezoid you'd see from a ditch, quote-unquote ditch. This is really trying to mimic a natural stream. And the intent of this stream is that in time it's going to move around within that U-shaped channel to find its stable location, and that's, you know, with the experience they've had, that was the design they requested in our applications, and we, you know, clearly wanted to do it. They thought was the best. The next slide is the issue we had to address at the outlet by the Red River north, where this channel comes into the Red River. It was trying to find its equilibrium between the elevation of the river itself and the natural channel, even though there wasn't much flow there, you still have erosion. So we had to try and keep that channel as stable as possible, yet get what we needed for structures and rock structures and stabilization. And, which is very important to the landowners, you'll see on some of the photos, they wanted to really keep the natural habitat, wooded, the wood, the trees along the channel, they wanted to maintain as many as they could on there. And that was our goal as well, because it's a habitat project, right? You don't want to knock trees down if you don't have to. So, and you'll see that at the outlet. But, so we had to make it, Jeff made a design that really fit that criteria that we needed to stabilize this channel. And these cross sections are very hard to see, but I just wanted to show you the last probably 8,000 feet, maybe 4,000 feet. Just before it enters into the river, there's very little excavation needed other than that little V channel that you guys seen on that previous slide. So I just wanted to show you the difference between what was taken out right near the outlet of the project versus all the sediment that accumulated over the rest of those 6 miles. You know, cross-section shows anywhere between 5 and 8 feet of silt over the last 100 years was in that channel that we had to take out. As you know, over 6.5 miles, you take out 6 feet of dirt, that's a lot of dirt.
I think just to note, too, just to put in perspective, the channel size is roughly 40 to 50 feet wide on top, and like Myron said, about 4 to 10 feet deep, in height or from top of bank to the flow line. So it kind of gives you a perspective on when you see the photos.
And the next slide and the next photos are just going to be slides. Before, after, we're just going to start at the, where the diversion structure is, and we're just going to go downstream all the way to the Red River. And I'm going to go through these just real, quicker fashion, but if you guys want to stop and point something out, feel free to do that. I've seen these so many times, but there might be something you go, hey, I want to, talk about that. So let's just, I'll just go through them. Okay. Now, this is the before. Again, these channels were very low grade wetland habitat. They didn't have a lot of function for any of your wetland experts. They just didn't have much going for them. So, so you know what was out there prior to 2012.
So, I have a question, and maybe I just missed it, but the channel that was abandoned, what happened to that?
It just filled in with sediment, and it was a big dike put on. It's a north flow to go through the original channel.
And who owns that? And is it habitat, or is it going to be found?
The new one?
The old one.
The old one was somewhere that was farmed when you get down to the lower ends, and this area was not farmed.
Which old channel are you talking about, where the water went 10 years ago?
Where the water went before you did this restoration.
Okay. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. The cut channel. The cut channel was restored just to keep for us erosion, to make some more erosion where sediment would get into the Red River from this channel. Because it still will be used, it'll still be functionable, but only all those flows are going to go through the new channel or the restored channel, and Jeff, I think it's a five-year event?
Yeah, anything over a two-year event, you're going to see a split flow. 100% of a two-year flow will go through the restored channel. And when you'll see a diversion structure, I'll show you photos of that.
So, just to summarize, it's still wildlife habitat.
Exactly. And we also, and what was what we did capture with their, even the restoration of or their of the cut channel, we did establish a buffer along the whole thing with sidewater inlet pipes to reduce erosion from the farm field. They were farmed right up to the edge of this channel. So this is the after picture taken just this summer. And you can note, you can see some of the private crossing. That's the first private crossing you're going to see on this project. And that's just for non-farm use. It's for recreational use. This is a look into the southwest on the first section of the restored channel. And this is the photo after the project's completed. You note, I'm going to see if we can backspace. You see the, and I don't have a pointer, but in the right side, you see the channel hits that road. That's a rerouted portion of the channel because we had a lot of wetland area or a lot of potential for wetland habitat in the lower portion of the project, and Jeff will show those, and he'll be able to identify them better in some of the slides. But we moved the channel to the north, and we also avoided about a $400,000 crossing by doing that. So it was economics and as well as part of our mitigation plan for the wetland restoration portion of it. Okay, we're, now we're, this is another crossing of the private crossing, single ATV pickup type crossings that was made on this project. I'll just go through and I'll just continue going. This is where it crosses one of the roadways. We have two large box culverts in these projects and for crossings for the county road. This is just, that was then we had to put one pipe slightly lower for fish passage on lower flows, but we also, had three of them there to handle the main flows.
So again, this area where the channel shows up, a lot of it was cattail, choked, farmed, on and off as permitted. And so this channel is really brand new through this corridor with the buffer. And again, not only does it provide the habitat, at the local site, but it also reintroduces the hydrology that existed over 100 years ago. Instead of having 1 square mile of drainage area to this site, now it has over 300. So you'll constantly get recharging of water into this riparian corridor.
Mr. Chairman?
Please.
Just a question, Brian. And this, I assume these are all easements that you have that permanently protect these buffers.
That's correct. They're all perpetual easements. Yep.
Thank you.
And a lot of them was in pre-rim acquisition. I should say the funding for the South Sandbar Beholders Council was for construction only. So a lot of the land acquisition was already taking place prior to us getting. We had the options signed before we even came to the side SAMS the third time for funding. So we had options for perpetual easements on almost all these properties prior to coming to the council for the final approval of funding. This particular land that you're looking at right now, this landowner didn't want to do any rim acquisitions. But we did get a buffer purchase from the perpetual easement from this landowner with no dikes installed, and that was really a big thing for the Corps for permitting. You wanted the water to go up and down naturally, from the Red River flooding. You didn't want any diversions. You didn't want to bring it to one spot. The Corps was really wanted to make sure that the water came up and down in a natural state. So, and the trade-off for this landowner was we could also raise parts of, because we had to dig out some of the dirt out of these channels, but we had to put it somewhere, so we just put it adjacent to the channel. But we also raised up parts of the farmer's fields so that they wouldn't be so flood-prone. and that was kind of a win-win. We stripped the black dirt out, put the dirt, you know, that we deposited out of the channel, and then put their black dirt on. So we raised their farmland somewhere around 3 feet. So that's really helpful when you're trying to get water off your land. But at the same time, we accomplished our goals. We got rid of the dirt cheap, and it was a win-win. These landowners, you guys, it was unbelievable. We had over 20 people at our first landowner meeting, and the only guy that spoke out against it didn't even have land on this property, on this whole project. And we didn't know that at the time, you know, because it was a public forum. But they kept, even through the whole process, we'd meet with them periodically to make sure that we addressed all their concerns, and they'd say, I still don't know why you're doing this, but as long as it doesn't cost us any money, we don't care. Okay, I'm just going to just continue on. Again, you see some of these crossings. This is just getting closer to the Red River. You're going to notice more woody habitat. This is very important to the landowners to maintain.
These photos were taken in August, just to give you a... So, I mean, the amount of water in the channel during August was impressive.
And during August, and the season was like in the end of June, early July, so there wasn't a lot of time for the vegetable. When you look at the right corridor, some of this is in Crep as well, or in Rim, I'm sorry, we invest in Minnesota. So we also had our perpetual easement that was for the project. But then the state, also, we got more people to sign up for Rim easements, because there are special appropriations from the legislators for Rim acquisition land. And the river was earmarked for this project and one other project in northwestern Minnesota. And we really utilized the rim to help get the land acquisition. Again, these are some of the crossings. And you note, I'm going to back up just, you note the difference in channel. That's where the cross sections, we said, was very little dirt had to come out of the channel from this point all the way to the Red River, the north. Again, just look at the habitat corridor.
Executive Director Johnson.
Mr. Gasby, you mentioned that the easements along this, along the corridor, the riparian corridor, is that primarily, and we don't see vegetation, or woody vegetation is primarily native prairie forbs and grasses?
Yeah, the stuff that we're seeing was native prairie. If it comes, we're not, from our point of view, we're not going to, we're just going to do weed management, and if trees start growing, it doesn't matter, you know, that'd be probably better, actually. But to stabilize the project quicker, we put it into a prairie, and if the trees come, so be it, and they will. This is where it all gets into the Red River of the North. And on your pictures, you can really see the rock ripples, and they're really fish structures. And also to bring the grade of the channel back up from the Red River elevation, but it gives resting areas for the fish as they come up. This was a real big thing for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service also, who helped fund this project, and I'll get into that a little later when we go into the funding. But it's very defined. This is just a picture looking from Township Road looking south. This is during construction. These are just to kind of show you how the U-shaped channels were constructed. They were all done with GPS equipment. If you were going to slope stake, if you guys know what survey is, you're slope staking these things, it would be a nightmare. That GPS equipment, right from the office computer to their GPS equipment, and it really worked well. It really makes the dirt work cheaper. And this is the project as it was completed. And this is after 1 year, because this year was the earlier. This is probably completed in 2013 and seeded, and this is 2014 or even 15. Again, just a typical section of what it looks like today, same spot. This is this is where the first, this is where the diversion is, right here. This is upwards of 8 feet of silt in this channel. You can't hardly see the channel anymore. This is just a really low-grade invasive cattail mass. And this is just a view of what the project looks like afterwards. A little hard to see, but then this really identifies it better. You can see where the cattails are still trying to think they're alive. They don't know yet that they're not going to live very long. But this is these will eventually disappear just from the hydraulics, and your native, your wetland prairie or wetland veg will take over. Now, this is what left the channel.
I'm sorry. I'm curious about your statement on the cattails disappearing, because my experience is cattails don't disappear. They pervade persevere in almost any condition without some very active management.
In this particular area, what we think we'll see is cattails, the hydraulics of the water level is going to determine how strong the cattail mass can be. And we feel that the channel construction is going to dewater the area laterally, and it's going to get rid of the cattails that think they're still alive out there. I'll give you an example. They're still alive. They just don't know they're dying. When we first went out to this site, me and Jeff, we could hardly drive a four-wheeler or walk anywhere. It was just very tough terrain to get into, either walking or ATVs.
It was real wet.
Real wet. The first year we went, after the first year they constructed this channel, we could drive anywhere we wanted to. And I was amazed, because I was wondering how we were going to be able to plow up this area that's been wet for 100 years and to even see any type of grass seed or wetland veg in there. And after the first year of dewatering it just from this channel, we could drive anywhere we wanted to, and by the time the contractor got out there, his tractor, they were out there with tractors, and they would have been buried the first 5 seconds they went in there, if it was, prior to this project.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if, like we do oftentimes in the legislative committee, if you've been slipped a note. I see Representative Crecia is here with her group, and I'm wondering who we've been invaded by. I was thinking maybe it was a bunch of Senator Lessard's friends, and they're wondering if this project that's so worthwhile, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if maybe you know who they are.
Well, I would call on Representative Crecia to introduce his group.
Well, maybe, Representative Crecia, if you could come down to the testifying table, and as you're coming down, maybe I'll also tell the group. This is a Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, named after two former senators who did great work in the legislature. And I know many of you buy things, and 3/8 of 1% of the sales tax spent in Minnesota is used for clean water, outdoor things. And this group spends or advises the legislature on the 1/3 of that 3/8 that goes to Habitat. And the project is a Habitat project that we're just happened to be reviewing, actually northwest not only of here, but northwest of where you are. I'm assuming when Representative Crecia introduces us, he'll tell us where you are. So thank you, Representative Crecia, for coming down. I'm Representative Denny McNamara. Three of the four legislators are here today that serve. My colleague in the House, Representative Lilly, is here, and Senator Saxaw is here, and all three of us have been on this group for a long time, and it's really important and really cool money that we spend here, and it's nice for you to come down and visit us, because we don't necessarily, it just so happens we're here today. And Mr. Chair, maybe I'll take the liberty, we're chaired by the mayor of International Falls, the 8th citizen members are all appointed by the House Speaker, by the Senate Majority Leader, and many of them by the Governor. And then the four legislators are appointed by their leaders in their caucus, the Senate Majority Leader and the House Speaker. So we serve here at the pleasure, generally, of other people. So thank you.
Representative Crecia, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McNamara. And first of all, I should say to you, Mr. Chair, I believe you had an unfortunate tragedy. And I'm really sorry to hear that. I read about that, and I hope your family's doing well, and I hope you're doing well. So
getting better every day. Thank you.
Good. Please, I know you're right across the river to Canada. Please don't go over there. Just stay where you are. We really like you here. So the group I have today is a travel group from Little Falls, Minnesota. They actually go to Long Prairie, Avon, Upsala, Little Falls, and Richmond, and it's actually a very interesting tour. It's called a mystery tour. So they didn't know what they were getting when they signed up. They were just going to come down here, and believe it or not, they got me. And so here I am. But it's been a great trip. So we've been around talking about the state office building, what we do, and I've been explaining to them how transparent we are and how easily accessible we are as representatives of government. And you've proven my point very nicely just by allowing us to come into the committee, inviting me up to introduce the group. So it's a great honor. So that is who you have there. And I should say, in the short time I'm listening, I absolutely agree unanimously with what you're presenting. So, Mr. Chair, I would hope that you ratify that.
Well, thank you. Thank you to this group for coming. And it's certainly great to have folks sit in and listen to some of what we are able to accomplish here with your contributions to the state. Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And we'll be less disruptive and we'll leave now. But thank you very much. And thank you, Representative Lilly and Representative McNamara, for acknowledging us. Thank you.
All right, I'll try to go quicker because I know we're a bit behind schedule. We wanted to show some pictures of what this channel looked like upstream prior to the construction. And I'll never forget the first time we came here when I showed this slide. And you can't see it here, but in the picture you can see ducks in the background. And I had a picture of it, and we have it farther in the presentation, of a spray coop right next to the area where now it's a wetland restoration area. And I remember Ron Sherrill saying at that time, because I had them right next to each other, you know, here's what it is today, here's what we hope it looks like. And I remember him pointing at this picture, and he goes, this is what I want that project to look like. And I think we accomplished that. And Ron Sherrill, if you ever are up in northwestern Minnesota, I'd gladly take you out on this site and show you where this was prior to the project and what it looks like today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jeff, and he can get over some of the diversion project and the engineering criteria that went into some of these design structures.
Thanks, Byron. I'm going to kind of jump around on the project, the outlet, the inlet, and kind of show a few more details. This is just a plan sheet that shows the outlet where the structure or the channel enters into the Red River. And you can see in your booklets, it drops about 10 to 15 feet within about the last 1,000 feet. Steep slope, a lot of erosion. So the intent here was to provide fish passage capabilities as well as stabilization. So to do that, and you'll see some photos, we provided a flat channel with no slope, with a 1 foot drop, flat channel, just kind of a stair step down to the Red River. And again, this is to promote fish passage, which was a huge feature in this project. One of the main objectives was to, again, allow fish to move from the Red River up into the Grand Marais and in the upper 20 miles of the Grand Marais, which they really wasn't promoted very well with the existing ditch. So again, a big factor of this project was that. This is what the channel looks like, I'm glad to say, before the project. Deeply entrenched, you know, anywhere from that upper terrace, probably 10 to 15 feet, up to maybe 25 feet to the field level. A deeply entrenched V channel. A lot of sediment that you see there is actually from the Red River that backs up in there and settles out. But again, fairly unstable. And the real issue here is right now this channel is seeing 15 square miles of drainage area. When the project's completed, it's going to see 315 square miles. A lot more stress on this outlet. So it was important that we armor this so that it would not head cut and continue to work its way upstream. So this is what the channel looked like before the project. This is looking from the upstream. You see the Red River in the background. Again, you see we really didn't change the shape a whole lot. Again, the goal is to maintain vegetation in both grasses and the woody vegetation, not only for habitat, but for stability. This next slide, we're starting construction. Show the excavator at the top of the bank, probably about 20 feet down to the bottom. And this is standing at the bottom of the channel looking toward the Red River. The slopes are about a 1.5 to 1, not a real desirable slope. But with the amount of rock we put in the bottom of this channel, we're hoping it'll provide a counterweight to the slopes, and also obviously armoring them. You can see these two big cottonwood trees.
It's kind of a landmark out there now. I've just seen some of the photos. We left those in place. Contractor didn't want to deal with them. They were huge, probably, what, 4 feet in diameter, maybe? So we left them in place, and almost became a landmark as well as stabilizing that outlet. You'll see in some of the photos where they show up. There they are in the background. But this is as we, you know, the rock is roughly the maximum size, up to 5 foot diameter, to give you an idea how big those boulders are, some of the bigger ones. The gravelish material you see is a filter that helps to protect the clay underneath. That was, again, a fairly expensive product, but significant in providing a buffer between the water and the clay, so we would reduce any, you know, erosion under the rock.
Mr. Langan, is the rock just field rock from the area, or is it some special?
This particular rock is field rock. It's not the crushed quarry rock that, you know, we use. You'll see in another photo, in another part of the project, we use crushed quarry rock. We didn't need that here with the velocities that we were going to see on the other site. So this rock is probably 25% to 30% less in cost. This is, again, just as construction is progressing. You can just see how we wrap around at the Red River. And this is in the fall when it was completed. You can see not a lot of water in the bottom of the channel. Again, this is just we constructed the outlet first to make sure when we open this channel up, this would be the most stable part of the site. And here we can see the rock. This is a completed channel. You can see the shape and the straw blanket where we have a seating underneath. And this is how it looked the following spring. We're starting to see vegetation. You can see the corridor. Try to keep it as narrow as possible. And here's this aerial view. Again, the important thing is, again, we've got about 10 feet of drop in the last 800 feet. So you can see those steps where you see those rapids. Those are roughly 1 foot drops, and then it's a flat grade in between. So it's really to promote the juvenile fish and even larger fish for spawning and for habitat in the Grand Marais area. And here's another photo looking upstream. Again, the sediment you see is from the Red River itself. And you can see the water quality difference coming from the outlet part of the channel where the Grand Marais enters the Red River. That darker water is very clear. You can see we're already getting fishermen right at the outlet.
This was not a staged picture. One of my board members is a pilot, and he just was out flying around looking at some of our projects, and he came upon this, the outlet of the Grand Marais, and seen that fishing boat right at the outlet. So this was not staged.
If you go on Google Earth, you kind of still see the old photograph pre-project. We've got a couple of videos here. I'm just going to show you quick. Just to let you see how some of these rapids were working, what the water looks like. Again, this is in the summertime after the project was opened up. It keeps repeating itself. And here's another one. This is talking. I hope there's nothing.
Outlet of the Grand Marais Restoration Project. You can literally see clean water coming out of it.
That's my board member saying you can do this stuff.
Jumping around there, but I just thought it was nice to see how the live photo or the water was acting. I mean, it's something that they hadn't seen there. And again, the contributing drainage area is really what is going to make the whole corridor work. You know, we talk about the cattails and the hydrology required for those. Well, also the habitat. We're really introducing that hydrology for habitat purposes, and hopefully for more desirable vegetation. Now I'm going to jump way up in the upper end. This is the diversion structure. This is where we cut the water off from the existing channel and force it to go down the restored channel. We decided to go with really just an armored, quarried stone, sheet pile, very basic, simple diversion structure. It's roughly 10 to 15 feet in height. This is a plan sheet that shows really the elevation difference. Looking to your left is where the channel still remains. We'll take high water flood flows That's been stabilized and vegetated, but we'll not see anything statistically over or under a two-year event. All the two-year event water and lower will go to the right of that sheet and veer off to the right of the sheet there, and that's where we've reconstructed the whole channel. This is where pre-project, where the diversion structure is going. So the water you see flowing from the top of that slide will now flow towards the restored Grand Marais. Just the construction equipment. Again, keeping the construction very basic, materials basic, we keep the costs down. We constructed a clay embankment compacted to specifications. Sheet pile we drove down for additional stability. Here we got rock being placed, and we're sloping back towards the... I'm going to back up for this last photo. You can see the restored channel in the background.
It's right on the top there.
So that's been completed. This was really the last step of the whole project, was to... Obviously, we didn't want to divert the water until we had somewhere for it to go. Again, just some construction photos as we progress. This is really the finished product. This is, again, looking downstream towards the old or previous PEP channel. The water in the bottom is all groundwater that's seeping into the bottom there, so it's not coming from the Grand Marais. Just a few. This is the photo I showed, I believe, initially. Again, it's just another view of the structure. You can see the sheet pile. The water, during high flows, would flow from the bottom toward the top of that slide. And this is the photo I showed you to begin with, and it shows the Grand Marais channel in at the top of the screen, and that's now where the water is going to flow. This really probably shows it best. You can see the PEP channel where the water went 5 years ago, and now this year when you drive out there, the structure forces the Grand Marais water to flow again along the channel that you see toward the bottom of the screen. I'm going to talk about the habitat restoration now. Myron mentioned approximately 400 acres of native vegetation was established. 200 acres of those prairie floodplain. 120 acres of wetland restoration enhancement. And 70 acres really of the channel, the habitat through the channel. So significant change from marginal farmland and marginal wetlands to now very desirable habitat along the corridor. I'm going to focus on a few spots. You know, this was a slide we showed when we came in 2012 on what we were proposing to do with the riparian or the area adjacent to the channel. The green there, it's all in your handout there, but the green is the prairie restoration. The blue and the blue hatch would be the wetland enhancement and wetland restoration work. But the red line is where we realigned the new channel. And this slide really kind of shows, again, what the wildlife focus was. You know, we were looking at fish passage at the outlet for the Red River, Northern Pike, Channel Catfish. We were looking at the waterfowl benefits, which would be in the wetland restoration areas, which I'll show. The prairie areas would be for white-tailed deer, even fur bearers, different type of channel mink and muskrat, things like that. I think the fishery element was the biggest, though. It was really trying to introduce this Grand Marais for habitat and spawning. I'm going to focus on these two areas of wetland restoration. Primarily the one to the left, where you see the arrow, was really where Myron mentioned we had that spray rig for agriculture. Again, several ditch blocks were constructed to restore or maintain pool levels in various locations we wanted to restore wetlands. This is the photo we showed with the spray rig, and I'm going to show several iterations of this photo on how it changed from marginal farmland into, I think, very desirable wetlands. This is actually looking at the same perspective. Again, a berm was constructed to maintain water on the upstream side toward the top of the slide. And this is how it looks after it was, you know, vegetation began to emerge. And in the lower left, you can see, I don't know if you can see how well, but there are some waterfowl already populating these pooled areas. And before we were even done constructing these projects. And that area that I just showed you is where that arrow is pointing right there. Here I just want to show you the different ground types. Obviously, it was all tilled and farmed, and some of the areas were just very choked and thick cattails. Those in those wetlands, the cattails will likely not disappear, but hopefully with the pool level and the water depth, we can maintain those long enough to maintain some of the water. Another wetland location, we've got berms on both sides of these pooled areas, so you see water on both sides of the berm there. And these are just some of the waterfowl, some photos we took on the project site. I'm going to show you how well populated this already was before the project was even completed. And this is another site, again, that was, the channel used to really go right through this site, and we still see it's adjacent, but yet, again, the Red River as well as the Grand Marais will bounce and recharge these wetland areas as they hadn't in the past. It was solely the Red River that would do that. I just want to briefly go through the crossings now. This was, again, a fish passage element. We didn't want pipes. We want to stay away from pipes in the bottom of the channel. So we had six private crossings we didn't couldn't afford to build under traditional bridges that we would see on public roads. So we decided to use railroad flat cars at about probably a fourth or a fifth of price. We had both. They're about 8 feet, 9 feet wide, so we had them for pickups and ATVs, and then we also had them for agriculture equipment. I just want to show you some photos. I guess the deal here we wanted to show, we looked at it from a fishery standpoint, thinking outside the box a bit and trying to make the project fit the budget. And we're predicting 35 years on these cars. So they're not the most beautiful things, but they are functional. And this is how we have three of these single lane, again, for ATVs and pickups. And then we've got three of the agricultural crossings here. Full, they span the channel perfectly. Just a perfect fit. And this is how these are double cars here. These are about 18 feet wide to accommodate large four-wheel drive tractors and pulp figures, things like that. But we were able to achieve the open channel again and not negatively affect, you know, fish from migrating up this channel. It's another photo of the signal. One last thing, bioengineering. We had probably a dozen stacks of cleared timber like this, and instead of burning and burying, we used all of it. In lieu of riprapping bends in the channel, we used, I think we quadrupled the quantity here, but we just thought it was in the best interest of this project to try to use as much of the natural resources we had and save the money. I mean, we were able to armor these bends in the channel instead of hauling rock on site. We were able to use this vegetation. It's a practice promoted by the DNR to help stabilize banks in lieu of riprap.
If you ever hear the word towood sod mats, or that's what these are.
These are towood sod mats. No, don't ask me to explain how those pertain to what you're looking at, but that's what they're called. I'm going to let Myron finish up with the project funding and costs.
Well, as you know, it's always, you know, hard to get funding for these types of projects, but what really, and I want to commend this council, when we got this $2.32 million from the Lassard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council, it opened up a lot of avenues that we could use, because we needed to get our foot in the door somewhere for funding. And in our small watershed, not small watershed district, but $6 million is a large endeavor for a habitat project. It's really hard to have to have a tax base to say, okay, you guys are benefited by this habitat project, so we're going to have just the landowners pay for it. It wouldn't have flown at all. So you look at just the breakdown of funding. What we also could incorporate into this project, a multi-purpose project, was flood damage reduction. There's a technical paper, number 11, that spells out what flood damage criteria in each of the zones in the Red River Basin, early, middle, late. And this happens to be in the early stage. And the best thing for an early stage is to get the water off the land before the water from the middle and late comes to the river. So if you can get the water off the land, that's a flood damage reduction strategy. And so we went to talk to Kent Lockesmore and the flood damage reduction and then our legislators and asked if we could get some flood damage reduction money for this project, which we received. With that flood damage reduction money, it's a 50-50 cost share. So the Red River Watershed Management Board and the Red Lake Watershed District also match that $1.3 million. And that's part of the agreements that we have with the bonding money for the flood damage reduction money. I talked about RIM. RIM was a huge component in getting landowners at the table to talk about land prices, to offer them this RIM, which was special appropriations from the state for these types of projects. The RIM money wasn't enough to pay for what the present values were of the land at that time, but the Watershed District Board voted to make up the difference. There was about a $600 difference from agricultural land to what RIM was willing to pay. So the Watershed District paid $600 plus an acre to each landowner for agricultural land to offset that cost. And once we got that barrier with the landowners, it was pretty much a slam dunk. Because all they ever wanted to do was compensated. If we're going to, you know, take this land out of sugar beets and soybeans, we need to be compensated fair market value, and we could accomplish that. The Working Lands Initiative, because it's in the prairie region, Pheasants Forever, you know, there's a whole bunch of folks that that make up Working Lands Initiative funding, but we qualified for that funding because we were in the prairie region. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that was a surprise. They were at our project team meetings all the time from the federal entity and really never had a lot of input. They never really, they had input as far as, what they wanted for fish criteria, but we never talked about money. Out of the blue in 2015, a gal from La Crosse, Wisconsin, which is in the region where we are, she called and asked if I could use $130,500 for fish passage for the Grand Marais because they had this project on their docket and rated as the number one fish passage structure or fish passage project on their in their region. So she asked if we could use the $130,500 for fish passage, and absolutely, because we were short anyway. Very next year, she calls me again and says, we have another $150,000 that we can give to you folks for this project if it would be something you could utilize. And at that time, we were still short of money. So we said, yeah, we'll take that too. So make a long story short, we come up, project cost a little over $200,000, probably over budget. The Red Lake Watershed District decided instead of just going to find funding for it, we just paid the rest of it. We figured for a $6.1 million project, if we could, we just make up to $200,000 and not go try and find some other funding source, because it's pretty much exhausting after trying to get funding for 3-4 years for this type of project. So made my life easier, and they were happy to do it. And then the final project cost, it just kind of breaks down all the components of the project and where we were. Again, the LaSalle Sands, it was really made it a lot easier. I didn't have to worry about land fees or titles or anything to deal with. So all we had to deal with was construction when we asked for our funding reimbursement. And to me, that really made it easier, because I know how difficult it would be to get for all these land, all the paperwork it takes to get the land acquisitions taken care of. So for me and Sandy, all we had to do was worry about the construction part of it. And still was a little difficult for me at times, but Sandy helped me through that. Conclusion is that we really feel this project turned out to be a very nice project. It was very educational for, all of our watershed district boards are made up of citizens. They're appointed by counties. They don't a lot of times get to see these types of projects, because a lot of times when you're in agriculture, rural America and northwestern Minnesota, a lot of the watershed district is putting, permitting culverts, doing some flood damage reduction stuff. So real eye-opener for my board, which is compromised and probably 3/4 of them are farmers, to really see a habitat project like this from the start to the end. And it was a real educational tool for a lot of the people in our watershed district, including our boards and counties. So hopefully we can get more of these projects on the ground and come back to you guys in the future for some other funding. Guys and gals, I just say guys. Guys are also girls, so.
Further questions for Mr. Jesse?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. I just wanted to thank the Red Lake Watershed District for doing such a great job with this project and really being persistent and having a lot of patience in order to get it done. When I was with Bowser, I went up to look at this project, and it was 2010. And it was just, you know, it's still so kind of preliminary, just a thought at that point, and you were starting to do some work, and you had been having a lot of conversations, and I haven't seen it since then, but I'm excited to get up there at some point and look at the results, because it looks like you really did a great job, and I just want to say congratulations on a really outstanding project up there.
For the comments, your questions. Great report, too. Just great to see and learn about all this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I just we were the first watershed district at that time to receive the Sarge County funding, and now I've seen through past legislations and appropriations that there's more. So hopefully you get the same result. But thank you very much again for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Desmond and Mr. Langan. We're just about on schedule. I'm going to take a 12-minute break. Be back at 10:15 just to take a few minutes break here for the folks. Just a couple of items left on the agenda, and first of those is the CPL liaison appointment, and Member Hartwell has graciously agreed to accept that. However, I think he has some conditions.
I don't know about petition, but first of all, if someone else wants to do it, I'm happy to let someone else do it, but I'm happy to do it for you if you'd like. The second is, it would be helpful for me to know what you want out of this position. What do you want me to liaise about and bring back to you? I'm happy to meet with them and make sure things are on track, but it would be helpful, not necessarily now, but at some point, to get a list of specific sort of what do you want coming back so that I fulfill your requirements.
Member Kingston.
I think Joe would be the best person to talk to about what we've done up until now in the last 6 months or so. And, of course, Jessica. But we've had done some groundwork about what the expectation is and how, you know, what the function is.
I guess I'm asking, what are your expectations
beyond that?
Because if you are looking for something, I'd like to know it so that I'm actually doing it instead of having you ask me why I didn't.
Member Olson.
That's logical. Actually, I've always been interested in the CPL process from how they score and select the proposals that are going to be funded and how that compares to ours. Maybe there's ideas that we can steal from them that would work well for us, and maybe vice versa. So if you could kind of take a look at some of that, that would be pretty awesome. And thanks for doing it.
Member Blackburn.
I'm interested in kind of the proposers and those that get funded perspective of if there are any difficulties in the process, or if there's any way that we can make the process easier for the DNR or the applicants through that. If there's policies that maybe are more restrictive or that maybe provide better guidance, that kind of end of it.
The only item I would add is that dollar level that they are working within, is that working well for applicants? Member Tilley.
Mr. Chair, I would, along the same lines, does it make sense to put in strata of projects? Because some people may have a small project that never floats up high enough. It's an important project, but there are other projects that have wider bases of support, but kind of overshadow the small project. See if there's any logic to having a strata.
Can the small project
right.
Get funded?
further? So for the record, I would appoint Member David Hartwell as the CPL liaison for the Sard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council. Thank you. Then move to, thank you, David, and then move to the public, and Les Bench would like to address the council at this time. Welcome back, Les.
Thank you. Good morning, council members. As an introduction, I'll give just a brief background. I served on the very first council for 4 years. I think the only original member is David.
Bill.
The rest are all new.
Bill isn't here, but he's in the original.
Yes. Yes, Bill is here. But I know the work that you go through. I know the time that you put in and the effort. And I thank you for your effort. It's a very important job that you have to do, and there's a lot of research, a lot of studying that's necessary to make the proper decisions. I just wanted to bring up a couple of items. I'm the owner of Viking Valley Hunt Club. It's a membership hunting club in western Minnesota. We're very active in the conservation projects. Our latest one is we've established an environmental research and learning center adjacent to our property in western Minnesota. We're working in conjunction with the University of Minnesota Morris, and we're going to be concentrating on environmental issues, primarily sustainable agriculture, aquatic invasive species, and the other one is pollinators. We're in a particular good geological location. We're sitting at the edge of the transition zone, western Minnesota, Otter Tail County. The Pond de Terre flows right through our property. It starts out at Eagle Lake, one of the tributaries of the Pond de Terre, and then just going a little to the west, we're on the Otter Tail, the massive Otter Tail watershed, and that flows over to the Red River. So we're in a very interesting ecological zone. We've got bee colonies on our property. We're going to be working with the University of Minnesota Maine, the bee lady, Marla Spevick, for instance, and Peter Thornton with the aquatic invasive species. And the sustainable agriculture movement is gaining a lot of strength, and it's an alternative to conventional agriculture. And it's moving fast. We've got several sites that were set up, and we're in the process of deciding what we're going to do as far as experimentation. One of those experimentation areas, University of Minnesota Morris is a land-grant college, and the Native American students go there tuition-free. We have approximately 10%, so there's approximately 180 students at the University of Minnesota Morris. And as far as the sustainability, we know that the Native American has probably done a lot better job of restoring, keeping the land in shape. And we've got a very good, rich history in that particular area with the Chippewa and the Sioux. So we're looking at doing some Native American history studies, looking at what they did in the past as far as preservation, conservation methods, so we can kind of bring that together in a very positive mode. Been working with Mary or Karen Diver with the Fond du Lac on the scholarship program to the university. So we're very actively working with the Native Americans in this particular area. The reason that I decided to come and just touch bases again with council, got some other work to do down here today, but there's an editorial, and I believe you have a copy of that editorial in the Star and Tribune, dated 14th of December. And when I read the editorial, I was disturbed as to some of the comments in the editorial. And my last position with the, when I left the council, I presented my issue with the transference of the land to the sovereign nation in the federal trust land, and I think it still holds true today. If I could just go through some of the items of concern that I've got with the editorial, and I did write a response to Mr. Klingensmith, No response back, of course. And if I could just take you step by step, the number one area in the editorial was the hunting is not allowed in the land now. I'm not sure if that's correct. The Sustainable Agricultural Initiative Act, whether that's applied to that land or not, absolutely requires hunting in the land. Now, potlatch, I know we've had problems in our hunting area with potlatch, but there was some differences in agreement on the taxation and the benefits associated with it. So whether that's a true statement or not, I don't know. But I don't know that they did a necessary job of researching it. On item number two, the voters' vision of the legacy amendment. Well, I'm representing a voter and a taxpayer in the state of Minnesota, and I don't think that the legacy amendment and the voters have voted for this to buy land and turn it over into a federal trust property that does not pay sales tax and they do not pay property tax. Now, I talked with the Department of Revenue 2 years ago. I reiterated that conversation and reinitiated that conversation yesterday. The sales tax issue is a one that's somewhat nebulous, but the way that the policy works with the Department of Revenue is that the Department of Revenue has no jurisdiction to issue any type of statutory law or revenue ruling with the tribal nation. We have no authority to do that in the state of Minnesota. This is a policy that they use, and the policy basically states that they estimate the taxation paid by the tribal members, and this estimate is then rebated to or reimbursed to the tribal authority. Net, net, no sales tax. Now, dispute that. Let's find out what the actual facts are. It's a little difficult once in a while to get information direct from the Department of Revenue. There's a certain secrecy that exists there. Item number four. The tribe is not buying the land. The tribe is buying the land with the money that the taxpayers in Minnesota from the sales tax and the allocation of $2.2 million. So again, it's a stretch of the appropriation and the wording here. Item number five, $15,000, almost $16,000 is a big deal to Clearwater County. It's not a rich county. And I think any county, I think, is a very severe hit. You know, over the next 10 years, that's $150,000. I think there's better ways of doing it. They state that in item number six that hey, we've done this before. Well, if we made a mistake in appropriations and allocations in the past, that does not constitute that we have to redo that mistake and continue to redo it. I think there's a definition of insanity in there someplace. My rebuttal to the editor is pretty much self-explanatory. On the sales tax issue, I'd like to get this, you know, settled once and for all and let the Department of Revenue make the definition and make it clear and concise as to what the taxation is. And as far as I'm concerned, from my definition of the Department of Revenue, there is not a sales tax liability that the tribe eventually has. Once the land is transferred to the sovereign nation, the property tax is not paid either. Now, my question is, with the proposal of turning that land, that 2,000 acres, is it 2,000 acres or 6,000? 2,000 acres. Over. If it was a WMA and the DNR would run it, it would stay as a property within the state of Minnesota and under the full taxation of their fill. Why was this rejected by the tribal authority? If they would have applied for maintenance funding of the property, I think it would have been supported highly. I think these types of proposals are going to continue to come and continue to rise. And, you know, as a observation of the ability of the tribal government right now, I question that. And as a factor of having a contract that is going to be enforceable with the tribal government at the state level, well, if we believe that, I've got some good properties, shorefront property on the Red River that I could probably sell too. But I don't think that this is an enforceable an agreement. It's going to immediately transfer to the federal level. And if we look at past history on the federal level, we've got a very slim chance of resolving any issues. And there will be issues in the future on this. There are bound to be. So that is my concern as a citizen, as a taxpayer, and I still don't know the reason why. The project is a good conservation project, but to take it out of Minnesota control, to take it out of the tax rolls, I think it's a poor move. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your time. Just to get back here.
Questions for Mr. Bench?
Thank you.
Thank you, Wes. Anyone else in the public would like to make your presentation to the council? If not, we would thank you, and we would move to the council work session, and I will turn that over to Member Kingston to come back.
Well, thank you. I guess I want a clarification if this is still our meeting or if it is a work session. We only have 6 members now, so by definition, we don't have a quorum, right?
No, we have a quorum. Once you have a quorum and begin the meeting, the quorum continues.
Even if they're not here?
Even if they're not.
With the exception if somebody calls for a quorum,
yes.
Or if you take a roll call.
Okay. Roll call vote, but not.
Okay, well then, in that case, I'd like to proceed not as a work session, but a continuation of our meeting, and actually have some council action on some of this list that you see in your package. But I'd like to introduce the package so that everybody knows what we're looking at. We have the draft call, correct, that will be sent out to get funding requests in March. We've got the agenda item 6, but it's actually 7. Oh, this was last time. So this is a repeat of what we had last time. This document from our last meeting was what we used to develop the checklist that's coming up later in your package. I tried to incorporate all the comments that were listed here, whether they're from counselors or from some of our partners, to try to get some kind of list of issues that we can address individually. Then we have 2 documents that were prepared by David Hartwell, who Member Hartwell wants to address them as part of the call. And so I direct your attention to those. And finally, we have a sample of a request for funding from a potential proposer. Then the meat of the matter for me is this spreadsheet that you see that's a list of word items, and we've broken them down, first of all, by showing whose role it is to do the work. S is staff, C is council, and I've broken it into 3 phases, phases 1, 2, and 3. I'd like to work on phase 1 today and possibly get into 2 if we can, and just go right down the list and move with your approval or cross them off if you do not.
Just a point of order. Given that there's only half of the council here, to your question with regard to having a vote on items, I mean, you can certainly take a vote, but it probably is more of an indication than it is where you're going to bring all of these back and have a final vote on the entire package at the end.
No, that is not what I wanted to do. That's what I wanted to avoid. I wanted to have votes meeting by meeting to actually get work done as we march along, and so that work can be done up ahead of time. And if we don't have enough people to do a formal vote today, then I'd like to get the group's recommendation to present at the beginning of the next meeting to vote on it.
with your approval. Do you understand me?
Well, you'd like a decision, a hard decision
on each item.
Yes,
right.
As I understand.
Yep.
And we can do that with the six members that are present because we had a quorum to begin. Greg, you have a point of order?
Yes. Mr. Chair, you've now put on record that you don't have a quorum.
Right.
So I would say that you don't have a quorum. Generally, the rule is in committees, once a quorum has been obtained, they continue to work, but nobody ever asks for it unless somebody asks for a quorum. But you've already put on record now that you don't have a quorum. So I would say that anything you do today would not be an official recommendation of the council.
So
it would
like
just
to,
be a preliminary.
I'd like to compile it as an advisory to submit to the next meeting when we do have a quorum to vote on it. And do work as we go along in our scheduled meetings this winter.
And Mr. Chair, Jane, that makes sense.
Okay.
But it wouldn't be an official vote of the council.
Right, understood.
You do not have a quorum, but you've already noted that for the record.
Understood.
So do you want to continue?
Well, and you know, to me, it's form over substance. What I really want is council approval on all of these things so we can avoid having to continue to argue about them into the future. I want to get a position on the record so that we can move on and face whatever new issues might evolve. Because the continuous improvement process to the Collins criteria should be working on it all the time, every year. We issue a call every year, and if there are needs that haven't been met and that should be met, then they should be adjusted every year. So what we'll do today, then, evidently, is a working session. We'll get a compiled advisory position on as many items on phase one that we can and put that into the package for the next meeting. And so my next question is, when are our meetings going to be? We have potential meetings set up. Another one this month, two more next month, and another one in early March. This is a lot of work to do.
And since I guess we don't have an official quorum, so I think maybe we adjourn the meeting and go to a working session.
Okay.
Thank you.